They stand for thoughtfulness, for some kind of inner experience of communion. The Indian medicine priest was not trained in medicine as we know it. He was not ordained to the ministry. He had none of the physical associations that we would compare with theology today. He was a little boy born in a tribe. Perhaps a family of maybe 50 or 100 people constituted his world. Here he lived. Here he wandered with them from place to place as they moved in search of food. This little boy, from a childhood, everyone looked at him. They said he was a very thoughtful child. He seemed to be a little different from most of the others. He was always quiet. He was never much involved in the games of the young people. He was not much interested in hunting or anything of that nature. He would sit and look at the sky, or he would sit and watch the birds' flight. He was just a strange lad. As he grew older, he did his vigil, for every Indian had to go out and have a long, heart-to-heart talk with nature. He had to leave even that little small family that he belonged to and go out into the desert or the forest or the wilderness. And there, placing his prayer plumes and smoking the pipe of sacrament, he would have to sit. Day, sometimes night, he would have to meditate and vigil, sometimes for 5 or 6 nights. But always in the end, the vigil was rewarded. The voices came to him. And the voices came to all those little Indian boys and girls. And what was more important still, the voices gave to each one of these his death song. One of the great duties of the voices was to take away forever the fear of death. Why? Because to these Indians, more perhaps than we realize, in their way of life, life swallowed up death. There was only life. Something we can't really say with a full conscience in many cases nowadays. But anyway, while he was out there in vigil, he had the vision of the Thunderbird, which was the phoenix. His totem was the great symbol of regeneration, the bird that rose victoriously from the ashes of its own dead. And if this was the totem that appeared to him, he was the priest. It was then his duty to serve his people as a religious leader. Among these people, as in many other clergies, the garments of the priest always combined male and female raiment. They had a life apart. Prayer and meditation was their way. They consoled the sick, comforted the dying. They performed many secret rites of simple magic, which they understood and knew. They also went out and found the herbs. They didn't learn about herbs from another medicine man. They had to go out in vigil and be told these herbs by voices from within themselves, voices that they called the voices of the olds and of the trues and of all the wisdom of their people since the beginning of time. And the old priests had remarkable experiences. And perhaps it can best be summed up in a few words today, is that there's a great deal of difficulty on most Indian reservations to prevent non-Indians from trying to get medical help from the old priests. They would much rather take a chance on the old medicine man than they would with modern science. But in any event, these things were part of a great tradition. The world was filled with life. The Romans had their lares and penates, spirits that lived under the hearthstone in the kitchen. The Chinese had the equivalent to it also, the Chinese kitchen god. Now, everyone would say that was pretty superstitious. But probably that was responsible for the fact that the Chinese and the Romans and Greeks who had these beliefs had very little indigestion. The reason being that if you really were a homemaker, and when you went to prepare the meal, these little spirits were there, and they watched you. And when you did the wrong thing, they said, that's not going to be digestible. They also had laws and rules of what man should be fed, and they expected these rules to be obeyed. And most of all, they insisted that the cook be happy. Any grudging cook would to them be a source of indigestion. If you weren't happy, if you didn't sing doing these things, which are the simple acts of life, then everybody was sick or suffered. And the food was tainted by the attitude of the cook. They believed that. It probably wouldn't hurt us any to believe it. It might possibly be of some value. It certainly would improve the general attitudes of families. And under these old mythological systems, families were much closer because they had common beliefs and common responsibilities. They held certain truths in common. When the Emperor of China, in the old days, came to the annual ceremony of giving honor to his father, the celestial emperor in heaven above, he went out alone, took off all of his robes of glory, put on a simple white garment, and went alone to pray at the altar of heaven. And there, in a very important ritual, the emperor, addressing heaven, which he really believed. He believed he was the son of heaven. He believed that he was appointed by heaven to rule his people, and that he ruled by the will of heaven. So when he knelt down, he had a prayer, and it ran a little bit like this in substance. He asked heaven to forgive him the mistakes of life. And if in his country there was hunger, if there was political disturbance, if there was war, if there was contention and discord, intolerance or intemperance, the emperor said to his celestial father, "Let me carry the blame. I am the ruler. If I have not been able to rule according to the rules of heaven, punish me, not them. For a nation that is in trouble because its leaders have not kept the rules." This was China. And while a lot of people today will not believe in Shangti imperial heaven, there are some practical aspects of that subject that might be given further consideration as to what constitutes the source of the responsibility for the tranquility and peace of a country. The Japanese have a very delightful ceremony every year in which the spirits of the dead come back. Now, this apparently arose in China originally in what we like to call ancestor worship. Now, ancestor worship to us would be completely unbelievable, or at least not very likely. But in China and Japan, ancestor worship is important. Now, the spirits come back, according to them. And they come back on a certain day of the year. And the family goes with lanterns to the cemetery to bring back the spirit of their relatives in a little procession to their home. They don't see the relative, but they know he's there. And they have a special seated table for him. And they give him a feast and a banquet. And they also know that he knows, by reading their minds, what their thoughts are. Therefore, it is necessary to have a pretty clean mind and be sure that all is well. And when the ancestor comes, he's going to be interested in certain things. And if he is pleased with what he sees, he will go back to the other world for another year and be very happy in a heavenly state. But if things on his living descendants are not good, and they've not kept the rules, then he goes back and he is very sorrowful. And it is a great mistake in Chinese and Japanese logic for the ancestors to be sorrowful, because there's only one reason why they can be, and that is because their living descendants have failed. So what the ancestor wants to know, for example, is the family in debt. For before this ceremony, it is considered necessary that every bill be paid, even if you have to sell half the family belongings to do it. Also, that the spirit wants to know that the husband and wife are congenial, that they're happy together, that they're working together for a common good, that all the children are happy and well-fed and all have had proper religious training, and they're all obedient, and they're all glad of the family they belong to. And they are taught, in turn, to be prepared so that when they grow up and their parents go into the world of spirits, that their parents will be always welcome to come back and find that their children are happy, contented, living well, working hard, cheerful, and religion-centered. Now, you may not believe in them coming back, but the end product has certain advantages, and that is that it makes these people want to try harder than most of us to keep the values which we must all keep if we expect to get along. It is the result value of these beliefs that we've lost. If we had some other way of making those values, it would be different. But when we took all of the gods out of the heavens, when we took all of the spirits out of the forests and of the lakes and the mountains, when we began to think in terms only of our own personal advantages in this world and forgot there was any other until too late, under those conditions, we have sacrificed some beautiful superstitions to get a group of new, unpleasant superstitions which are just as unprovable. There is no way in which we can prove that there are not celestial beings. There is no way we can say that all the inhabitants of nature are visible to us, because we have a very limited visual field. We would have to deny many experiences that we accept without question. And yet, in a mysterious way, we have lost the fantasy. We've lost the charm and beauty and wonder of the life of these older people, a life in which there was much more individual integrity, even though there were many times of great trouble. But out of this also came another thought that has supported a better way of life than we have at the moment, and that is that the ancients who had these beliefs actually had what they believed to be irrefutable evidence that these beliefs were true. They realized what we find out in a different way. But they realized, even in their time, that the individual who violently breaks the rules of life nearly always suffers, and probably always suffers, although perhaps sometimes we are not present to see the suffering. That those who have not love and beauty and truth in their hearts are sick. And they, in those days, found that all of the good things of life seemed to come to them from an invisible cause. They found that in sorrow and misery that they wanted to raise up their voices in prayer. We still pray, because some way we know that beyond our unbelief, there is a greater believing that is true. Now, we don't have to go back again to the superstitions of the past, but we do need to deepen our own believing. We need to have a greater resource in personal internal insights. Today, things are breaking more or less in that direction. More and more now, the importance of the unseen is regaining its domination in life. More and more, we are beginning to realize that we cannot live by bread alone, especially white bread. We also are beginning to recognize the tremendous importance of visualizing a larger universe with greater rules, greater purposes, and greater achievements than those of one little planet. We also are coming more and more to realize that to discover the great truths of life, we will have to do what the old Indian did, or the Egyptian priest, or the Greek mystic, or the early Christian saint. We have to commune with life itself. We have to be still and know if we want to know what the rules are. We cannot simply take these rules from each other. We've got to search inside of ourselves for the source of these rules. We've got to make peace with our own inner lives. And we cannot do this without a recognition of a divine presence available to us at all times. So gradually there is a return of the mystics. There is a return of the belief in the sages and the saints of old. There is a greater need for the recognition that the processes of nature are not merely automatic. The Greeks believed that flowers and trees were taken care of by little elemental spirits who guarded them and guided their destinies. That everything that lives has a protector, and everything that lives must in its own turn protect something else. Man, being a comparatively advanced creature, has many things it must protect. He must gain the wisdom and the will to be the good gardener in his planet. He must also be the kindly guardian and custodian of other forms of life less than his own. At the same time that he is serving, he is then earning the right to enjoy an intercession of power greater than his own. His religion must be based upon service. As he serves others, so he is served. As he brings joy to the life about him, a greater power brings joy and contentment to him. Everywhere in life, there seems to be an intelligence working within each of us. And then long ago, someone came upon the very important realization that this divine power has its seat in us. That there is a tremendous divinity locked within each of us. And the face of that divinity is visible in our face. Actually, God has as many appearances as there are creatures. And the deities are all of them embodied within forms and work through these forms into manifestation. Through meditation upon the archetypal forms of these principles, we slowly transform the universe. It is no longer just a mass of laws and chemicals and processes. The universe suddenly becomes what one of the Buddhist priests that I knew called it, the Great Commune. The universe is one vast culture. It is one tremendous world. It is a cosmic universal democracy. The universe presents equal opportunity for all and special privilege for none. This great commune has as its ultimate the gradual manifestation of its purpose and pattern in every structure that man himself builds. Architecture, according to the Vitruvian canons, was a human representation of the laws of life as they relate to stress and pressure and harmony of form and materials. Therefore, the building was a symbol of an invisible building composed of the eternal principles of mathematics and science. In the same way, everything that we construct, everything that we build in our own minds and hearts is based upon great archetypal forms that exist forever in nature. And all these archetypes are alive. They are not just dead things. There is nothing dead. Even the belief in death cannot kill us. Because there is something that is inside of us always. And this thing that is inside of us, it symbolizes itself outward into various forms and manifestations. The Greek heroes represented those who had by internal achievement transcended humanity. They were still of the human family, but they had earned a conscious participation in the divine light. They were children of God who had discovered their heritage and were therefore chosen to perform the works of God. We call them saints. In other religions, they are called arhats, sages, initiates, adepts, whatever you wish to call them. But they represent those human beings who have found their way back to the realization of the divine plan. And as Milton in his Paradise Lost unfolds the invisible structure of the universe, filling it with beings, all of them, of vital, powerful forces. So I suspect that one of these days our astronomers and physicists are going to rediscover that all these principles and energies and substances that they work with are beings. For there is no substance from the smallest atom floating in a sunbeam to the greatest galaxy which is not composed of life. Every unit of existence is alive. And wherever there is life, there is growth, unfoldment, evolution, process. Wherever there is life, the eternal is breaking through the temporal. That which must be is gradually achieving a victory over the mistakes, limitations, or frustrations that have resulted from ignorance. Therefore, always, everything is alive. And when a thing is alive, we approach it a little differently. When we find or have a little kitten or a puppy dog, it's alive. Therefore, we feed it and we cuddle it and we love it and we talk to it and we believe in it because we can see its life. But all around us are forms of life that we don't see so readily. And even if we do see them, we do not really feel their presence as we should. But sometime we're going to realize that there is nothing in the universe that has not a destiny of its own, and that our labor in every case is to advance the destiny of the thing as it is, and not simply to bind it to our purposes. We have a destiny to fulfill. Everything is growing and moving, but it is growing and moving in an intelligent living pattern. This is part of the burden of the mandala symbolism, which we find in many Asiatic countries. It is a picture of the universe of values. It is a picture of space inhabited by life rather than by body only. Every planet suddenly becomes a living thing. Every star is a divine principle. We may call this a kind of belief. We may even liken it to heathenism. But the substance of it is inevitable. With a certain amount of reintegration, reinterpretation, we shall find that there is nothing in the universe except various stages of divinity. That this divinity, which we cannot estimate, we have symbolized in various ways. The symbolism is very humble, very inadequate. But after all, man is the highest creature that man knows. Therefore, he has made God in his own image. But this does not mean that he has made it merely in the image of the body of deity. The God that man has fashioned in his own image also contains within it the infinite potential that is also in the potential of man himself. Man who makes deity in his own image bestows upon this image the infinite capacities which man recognizes in himself. He realizes that actually this deity is a vast being, and man himself is a somewhat less vast being. But to the cells and atoms of his own body, man is a universe. And to some little tiny cell within his bloodstream, man is greater than the whole of creation as we see it. And every little cell faces in its time the same black hole we are trying to explore in the cosmos. There is the cosmos within us. There is an infinite life. And every living thing in us is alive. And out of this pageantry, the ancients decided there were only two kinds of beings, both alike in principle, but one visible and the other invisible. One perceptible, other beyond perception. but that there was no such a thing anywhere as death. There's no such a thing as the lack of life. And there's no living thing that is not controlled by a divine law. And in the embodiment or personification of that divine law as it operates on all levels of nature, we have theology. And this mystery of all the deities is nothing more or less than man giving a being to a principle which operates. Man has made a deity out of a reality which is invisible. But this reality he knows from daily living, he shares in. He knows that he is alive. He knows that the greatest mystery of all is his own existence, and that this existence is impossible unless behind the visible form of things is a vast invisible causal pattern, the archetype of everything that is visible. And wherever the human being has created a picture of this archetype, he has made it up of beings which become, in a sense, the personifications of processes. He makes them into beings because he has discovered in himself that processes are intelligent. The ray of the sun has not only its warmth, but its wisdom. And every drop of water in the ocean is not only wet, but is composed of an infinite solicitude for life. All living things of every condition have moral purposes. All forces operate morally, and they are not immoral unless man attempts to dispose of them maliciously. Where the individual wishes to misuse a force, that force turns upon him. The force is never bad, but the force will correct the errors of the wayward. So there is only one thing to really understand, and that is that we live in the visible half, in the visible hemisphere of a great unity of life. We live in something that is ever living, ever loving, ever kind, ever helpful, ever searching to make us better, ever contributing to the happiness which we all desire. And between us and this realization is a small material personality, a series of customs based upon misinformation and misinstruction, by means of which we have closed off the reality of the greater part of the universe in which we live. We have cut everything down to our own level. We have taken away from ourselves all the overtones. And the moment you take the overtones from music, you destroy the music. The most important part of life is the part we do not see, but we constantly experience. We feel it, we sense it, we know it exists. And it is this over-existence that justifies our mortal existence. And in art particularly, we see this. But we observe with great tribulation, so to say, the way in which we've gradually closed out that which we did not want to understand. We have tried to prove conclusively that existence is an amoral state. We want to believe that there are no integrities that can interfere with an individual doing what he pleases. We want to have the feeling that we are not disobeying anything because there is nothing to disobey. We want to live as we please. We want to advance the various causes without interference. And little by little, these materialistic instincts and appetites are getting us deeper and deeper into trouble. Now, if at the end of the era of superstition, we came into a wonderful scientific enlightenment, and everything has been better ever since, we might pause for a moment. But I think it is well to realize that as our idealism failed in our procedures of life, our materialism has moved us from one disaster into another. In the last 100 years of human civilization, while it has had the greatest materialistic enlightenment and has been preaching its code of materialism industriously, that this last 100 years is probably one of the most difficult and tragic the world has ever known. We've had many times before that were not good. But we have never before had the combination of the wisdom and experience that we now potentially possess and find ourselves using it as badly as we are using it today. So all of the advancements of science and education have not, generally speaking, protected the human being from his own mistakes. There's only one way in which he can be protected, and that is he's got to protect himself. And he's got to protect himself by not making the mistakes. Because it's as in the case of health. An individual who is disobedient to the laws of health long enough finally reaches the point where his condition is incurable. So it is not possible for us to continue without ultimately getting into serious trouble. We need desperately to remember the living universe and our responsibility to it. We do not have to worship the deity on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel in Rome that's throwing out the sun in front and the moon behind. No one really believed in that. No one believed that God was an old gentleman. But everyone believed that the principle of wisdom, the sage, the great thinker, the grandfather, the wise one of old, they went to find the nearest thing they could use to picture something that they could not picture in its fullness. So deity became parent, and parent became like father or mother, and became a basis of an artistry with these interpretations. The Hindus do not believe that God has many arms and many heads in our sense of the word. But they do believe that every head in the world is part of the divine head, and every arm is one of the divine arms. Every living thing is part of an abstract divinity that is the fullness of all things. To get some of this back a little bit and get back to the idea that we live in a family rather than an institution. We more or less institutionalized human society. We are living in a combination of a technical laboratory and a reform school. We are being guarded against our own mistakes by the people who are responsible for making most of the mistakes. This is not what it is. We are not born to live in a laboratory. We are not born to live in a constant condition of punishment or retribution or anxiety. We are here to live together as a visible part of the great unity of life. The unity of life, which is the whole world, the whole universe, and every part of it is alive. And every part of it is something we can reach. One of the mysteries of prayer that has been a problem for a long, long time is how God listens to all the prayers. Well, the answer is that there is a God in the person who is praying, and that is available to him at all times. It is the divine part of himself with which he must form an occasional union. He must experience the presence of a power greater than his objective personality. And the pure power of life within himself is one with the life of all that exists, the divine power infinitely diversified. Gradually building in a little of this romantic tissue into our way of life, the gradual recognition that there are wonderful stories that are going to come true, and that the time is going to come when idealism is going to help everyone to live happily ever after. When we begin to realize this and live more in the charm, in the quietude, the peace, the joy of faith, belief, and the security of inner conviction, things are going to be much better all around. We have gained a little something of intellectual brittleness by our present course of procedure. But we've lost the power to love in a simple, honest way. We have lost that power of love which makes us wish to give of our love. In the Canticles of Solomon the King, the Song of Solomon, the king, the wise king, describes love in three ways. First of all, he says in the opening part of the Canticles, "My beloved is mine." About halfway through the book, he says, "My beloved is mine, and I am my beloved's." And at the end of the book, he says simply, "I am my beloved's." The self has disappeared. And this is part of the experience that we all have to have. But until we find the simple love of each other, we're not going to be able to experience, define, or image the love of God correctly. Until we experience all these better virtues within ourselves, we're going to live in a universe with a blank sky above us, filled with stars that we hope to conquer someday. But when we conquer them, we will still be born, we will suffer, and we will die. Because this is not the way it was intended to be. Instead of that, we've got to restore the intangible world of beauty within ourselves. We've got to have our own legends and our own lore, our own mysteries. We're going to have our own fantasies, our own great music, great poetry, great artistry. We must restore these values, or the lack of them will lock us forever in a materiality that has no existence except in ourselves. But we must release ourselves into the larger world, which is practically populated with nothing but deities, because every principle is there. Everything is great. And sometime we're going to reach up there and realize that among the deities which will exist in the world that was fashioned for it is humanity itself. We are of the gods. We are part of the gods. And it is our privilege and our duty to claim our heritage through right conduct. Only in this way and in these manners can we understand the symbolism. But it is a valid symbolism. It is a wonderful thing to realize that the ancients were wise enough to make everything alive, and that we have been foolish enough to believe that we could kill anything. The only thing that we can really destroy, even temporarily, is our own hope. And we have done that long enough. So in the spirit of the highest aspect of spiritual conviction, we must not only restore the kingdom of heaven, but we must also restore the garden of earth, which we were supposed to take care of, and to make a beautiful place for all human beings to live. And when we do that, according to the promise, then the Lord will be with us in the cool of the evening, and we shall know the whole mystery of life. It's a problem of fantasy, perhaps, but fantasy that is stronger than life or death. Fantasy that is eternal. Well, I guess that's all for this time, folks. I have an announcement I'm going to ask if you'll be patient.